This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. President Bush has made it clear he understands American voters are frustrated with the war in Iraq. He met yesterday with leaders of the Iraq Study Group, the bipartisan panel headed by former Secretary of State James Baker and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, to explore policy options on the war. Democratic congressional leaders have said they want American troop withdrawals to begin in 4 to 6 months, but the president cautioned yesterday that any military options must depend on conditions on the ground in Iraq. For a look at what's happening on the ground and what military leaders think about policy alternatives being discussed, we're checking in again with Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for the New York Times. He's the author with General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Gordon returned recently from several months in Iraq. Well, Michael Gordon, this is a time when a lot of people in Washington are beginning to rethink Iraqi policy. And you wrote in a piece recently that the military actually embarked on its own effort in September to assemble some of its best minds to begin considering what some alternatives might be. Who are some of the folks that the Army taps for this, and are there new ideas that they're offering?
Well, it's interesting what's happening in Washington now, because for the longest time, the Bush administration insisted that they had a good strategy for Iraq. In fact, they called it a strategy for victory. They talk about it in somewhat less ambitious terms now. But nonetheless, they started out with a strategy for victory, and the officials and the military were reluctant to acknowledge that they were doing any work on a plan B, because that might indicate that the strategy for victory wasn't going to be successful. Well, now, particularly in light of the election, everybody is advertising that they're doing new thinking, recognizing that the initial strategy basically failed. It needs to be adapted at a minimum. And the military is very much like that. So General Pace, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was saying recently that stressing that he's taking a new look at our strategy in Iraq. And really what has happened is in the September time frame, General Pace pulled together roughly a dozen or so officers and gave them the task not only to look at Iraq, but also Afghanistan and other areas in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, and kind of brainstorm and come up with new ideas. What's interesting to me is these are people who have been on the ground in Iraq, who have fought there, at least many of them are, fought there and had some success there, spent a significant amount of time there. For the Army, it's a year-long tour. For the Marines, it's 7 months, and sometimes these people have spent several tours there. So these are some of the brainier, more innovative guys in the military, and they've been pulled together in what is still a pretty close-hold operation. No one's talking too much about what they've come up with, but what I've been told is that they're not looking for the lowest common denominator. They're not trying to produce a consensus document that all 13 or so of them can agree on, but rather throw out an array of ideas that General Pace can select from in advising the president.
You know, you wrote in early October, apart from this effort that you just described, you wrote in early October that the Army and Marines were finishing work on a counterinsurgency doctrine that makes the welfare and protection of civilians an essential element of military strategy. And I'm wondering, has that doctrine affected the practice of soldiers and Marines in Iraq that you can tell?
Well, that effort actually should be formalized any day now. I was writing from an earlier draft of the document, sort of really essentially the final draft, and it will officially be released, I think, very soon. I think the drafting of the new counterinsurgency doctrine is an important step in changing the culture and mindset of a lot of people in the Army and Marines, but I think it is more informed by the experience in Iraq than informing it. And by that I mean, for 3 years now, the American military has been in Iraq, and when you're out there, you see a lot of units, and they know all this, and they've learned that if you want to win over the population, you have to be very discriminate in the use of force, and that it's important to get the Iraqis to do as much as possible. And the doctrine is really drawn on the lessons of Iraq, but it's with an eye toward training the American military for Iraq and future contingencies, because whatever you think of all the different recommendations in Washington, I suspect will be in Iraq for years to come in one capacity or another.
You know, there was a set of pictures that were going around on the internet, and I think that it may have been captioned something like pictures you won't see in the New York Times, but there were a series of photographs from Iraq which showed civilians expressing enthusiastic support for American presence and posing in friendly ways with American troops. And I wonder what your impression is of the extent to which Iraqis welcome and value the American presence. I'm sure it varies around the country, but what's your sense?
Well, first of all, those are pictures you would find in the New York Times. But there was a drive-by killing, and I was with a captain who was trying to meet with the Iraqi police and stop these sorts of killings and find out what they're all about. And we were leaving the Iraqi police station, and there was a woman sitting there, standing there, and very sad expression on her face with an old man. They'd been there all morning. No one was paying the slightest attention to him. Turned out it was the wife of the guy that was killed. She was just trying to get into her own police station and get a document so that she could get the body of her slain husband and bury him. No one was giving her the time of day. So this American captain, Albertos, he was coming out and he says, "What's this?" And the interpreter, the Terp as they call him, says, "Well, this is the wife and that's the father." And he says, "What do they want?" He says, "Well, they just want a piece of paper so they can get her husband's body out of the morgue." So the captain turns around, goes back into the police station, and he talks to the Iraqi policeman and says, "Listen, can you give her this paper?" And the guy says, "No problem, can do." But you just got the feeling that this was just going to go into some big in basket somewhere and nothing would happen. So this American captain said, "No, we're going to take care of this right now." So he grabbed this Iraqi police commander. He took the wife and the father, and we all headed off to the Yarmouk Hospital together. And he said, "We're gonna get this solved and squared away right now," because I think he had the sense it wasn't going to happen. So we get to the hospital. Again, a lot of run around. There's nothing we can do. You need this. You need that. American captain says, "Where's the morgue?" He marches to the morgue, presents the document, and there's a problem for Iraqis even to retrieve their dead, and this is the problem. They're fearful that the very people that killed, you know, their relatives will be watching the hospital so they to see the relatives, because they know the relatives will come to get the dead, and then they'll target the relatives. So they're in jeopardy sometimes when they go to the hospital to get their dead. And also there's concern that some of the ministries, the health ministry in particular, is run by the more radical Shiite elements. But anyway, we got the body back. They put it in a kind of a plywood casket, strapped it to the hood of a Chevy Caprice, which was their car, and then the Americans' Stryker vehicles provided the escort across the city so she could get to some protected area and bury her husband. It was very unfortunate, I thought, that it took American intervention for this woman to safely retrieve the body of her dead husband and get him to a cemetery to bury him. And I have to think, I don't know what she thinks now, but I have to think that there's some measure of gratitude, at least if not to the American forces, who she may blame for this whole problem, at least to that captain who took the time to help her out in her distress when nobody else would.
My guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. Also, he is also author with General Bernard Traynor of Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Well, I want to talk a bit about some of the policy alternatives that Americans are now going to be exploring in Washington now that the elections are over, and the American public seems to have sent President Bush a message of disapproval about the Iraq War. Of course, the Iraq Study Group is going to be This bipartisan group is going to be looking at policy alternatives. It spoke this week with the president and some senior administration officials. And a lot of Democratic leaders in Congress are saying they will press to begin withdrawing troops in 4 to 6 months Republican Senator John McCain says he thinks more troops are needed. Do the military leaders you speak with think they can succeed in Iraq with fewer troops?
No. I think that, I think, you know, the military as an institution has a variety of voices and opinions, just as the media does and just as the political class does. So there's no one viewpoint within the military. But I think that most of the people I've talked to who've been in Baghdad think that the notion of reducing American forces there on a fixed timetable is not useful. And I, too, see some problems there. I mean, the situation in Baghdad is pretty precarious right now. And the situation in Al-Anbar province in western Iraq, take the provincial capital, Ramadi, that's essentially up for grabs. And I don't see how having even fewer forces in the near term makes that situation more secure. You know, for years people have been complaining that Rumsfeld didn't send enough troops, which I believe is true. And now that we're in a very critical phase of this operation in Baghdad, people are saying, well, we need to have fewer troops. So I'm not quite sure how I follow the logic of that argument, especially if you're doing it on a fixed timetable, if something has to happen in a few months. Well, then the argument becomes, the people who propound this view, that, well, the reason we need to reduce is to prod the Iraqis to do more so that their security forces can take on more responsibility. Well, we've already seen that their security forces don't always acquit themselves well. So just turning things over to them might encourage the prospects of civil war more than reduce it. I mean, Iraq is a very, very complicated place. And what concerns me a little bit is that some of these policy alternatives that are being discussed in Washington seem to be fashioned with an aim to gaining a consensus of what might be acceptable in Washington, not necessarily what would work best in Iraq.
Michael Gordon is my guest. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times, and he's author with General Bernard Traynor of Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. You know, I guess there are something like 140,000 troops in Iraq now. Is that about right?
It's about right. It fluctuates because we're in a transition phase where the 4th Infantry Division is going to be coming out and the 1st Cavalry Division is coming in. And so there's a bit of overlap while that occurs. But, you know, it's in that range of 140 to 150.
Well, you know, I just think back to the mid-60s in Vietnam when you had a small American presence go to a substantial American presence. And as it went poorly, you know, more troops were added to try and stabilize the situation until by, I guess, 69, you had 540,000 American troops. And it still didn't go well. And I guess I'm just wondering, those who look at the impact of increasing the American presence in Iraq, would doubling the troops make a big difference? Would you have to triple the amount of troops? What are people thinking?
Well, if you look at the number of forces we have in Iraq, what's really striking is it's stayed pretty constant. I mean, it's fluctuated between 150, 140, down to, towards 100, but it's always been within that kind of range. So my sense is the reason we have the current number of troops in Iraq is not because it's the correct number. It's not. It's too few if you really wanted to secure Iraq. But it's because all we're capable of deploying, because our army is too small for all of the missions that's been thrust upon it. We haven't even talked about Afghanistan. That's beyond the scope of this conversation, but Afghanistan's become a very difficult situation. NATO's involved in there. There are 20,000 American troops in there, and they're probably not enough. In fact, the senior British commander in Afghanistan recently said that implied that they needed more forces there. As he put it, if you want to win quicker, you need more forces, because he's trying to be politic and not saying they don't have enough. So we have the number of forces we have in Iraq because of it reflects more the size of our own military more than the requirements of Iraq. And I think certainly in the past we should have had more if our goal was to secure Iraq and fight the insurgency. Really, the hope and the calculation on the Bush administration's part, and I think on, among many of the people in Congress, has been, while we need more forces, we're going to rely on the Iraqis to provide the increased number of troops. That's been the Bush strategy, that's been General Casey's strategy, and I think that's the Democrats' strategy. The question McCain, I think, and others are asking is, what if they don't provide those extra troops? And the issue they're putting on the table is, would it be worth a sort of a one-time increase in Baghdad? Let's say, increase 50% or 100%, I don't know. And just to try to finally gain hold of the situation there. If you wanted to do it, and I don't think we're going to do it, but if you wanted to do it, it could be done by extending the troops that are currently in Baghdad as the new division comes in, because, as I said, we don't have enough forces to do it otherwise. You'd have to prolong the deployment of the guys in Baghdad. That's the issue McCain is surfacing. The thing is, the election seemed to cut in the other direction. It seemed that the public is yearning for a way to extricate ourselves out of Iraq, not for a greater involvement. And there may be a bit of a paradox there, which is that there is no easy way out of Iraq, and you may have to get a little more involved in the short run in order to extricate yourself in the long run.
I don't want to leave without just taking stock a bit of Donald Rumsfeld's tenure at the Department of Defense. Of course, he was known for trying to reshape the American military to be a leaner, lighter, quicker force. It's acknowledged that he seems to have made some mistakes in Iraq, not bringing in enough troops, particularly after Saddam Hussein fell. You write about that in your book, failing to bring the 1st Cavalry Division in. But I'm also curious about looking at Iraq more broadly, whether you think the experience there renders any verdict for Rumsfeld's vision of the American military. Did he make the kind of military that he wanted to, and what does the experience there tell us about how effective it was?
Yes, it's a very good question. And one thing I would say is that Rumsfeld's vision of what the American military ought to look like was not Rumsfeld's alone. It was also President Bush's vision. People forget that as a candidate, Bush campaigned on a platform that he was going to bring transformation to the American military to essentially create a leaner and more lethal military. And he gave a famous speech, at least famous to people in defense circles, maybe nowhere else, at the Citadel in 1999, where he laid out this vision. And in fact, he said, I'm going to appoint a strong defense secretary to carry this out because I know it's going to involve changing a lot of the bureaucracy and culture of the Pentagon. So the president himself chartered this course. My sense is that there's some merit to that. I mean, getting the services to work together better, what they call jointness, I mean, that certainly is a good thing, and taking advantage of high technology weapons and precision weapons and reconnaissance systems, that's good if you want to be effective. But, you know, the problem was President Bush and Don Rumsfeld were so wedded to this vision of what the military ought to look like in the future that it really led them astray in Iraq. And in fact, it's one reason why we have this mess in Iraq. Because, you know, a force that's leaner and meaner, that's great when the goal is to get to Baghdad quickly. And the precision weapons come in very handy when you're trying to destroy, you know, the Republican Guard. But once you topple the regime, mass has to substitute for speed. And it doesn't matter whether you got to Baghdad in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Once the regime is toppled, you have effectively taken ownership of that country. And in order to secure that country, you just need lots of troops to do that. It's a very labor-intensive task. The precision weapons can't compensate for that. The reconnaissance systems can't compensate for that. All the whiz-bang gadgetry won't do the job. You need folks to close the borders and seal them so the jihadists don't get in. You need to provide security in the Iraqi capital so that the people feel they can walk on the street without being molested by criminals, and they look on the occupiers at least as a competent force that can protect them. you need to provide enough security that different sects don't have to create their own militias. Why did the Shiites begin to form Shiite militias? Because they're being attacked by Sunni insurgents, and we didn't have enough forces to stop that. It doesn't fit nicely with Rumsfeld's vision of a transformed military that's smaller and which relies more on technology. So there is, he left office with, a pretty considerable tension and some confusion, really, in terms of American defense policy, which I don't think is really going to be sorted out anytime soon.
Well, Michael Gordon, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Michael Gordon is chief military correspondent for The New York Times. He's the author with General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.